G'day team, welcome to another instalment of The U Project. Craig Anthony Harper for the 373rd time. Is that right, Melissa?
That 373? Is correct. 373.
Wow, that's a lot of episodes, isn't it?
It's a fair few.
Do you remember number one?
I do remember number one with Nathan.
Who was number two?
Jackie Lauder was number two and Mick Hall was number three.
Oh, wow. You are truly Rain Man. You truly do have that on instant recall. All right, what date did my dad have his heart attack in whatever? What year was it and what month was it?
Okay, I'm going to go the 10th of April, 2012.
See, I wouldn't know. I've got no idea. Is that true?
As far as I'm aware, you had just finished radio when you got the call and then you headed off.
I think we're going to get you tested because you may not be totally biological. I think there could be some technology in you. But I tell you who is totally biological, I think, is Dr. Gemma Foxall. Hi, Gemma. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well. Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being had. Very grown up. You're just so well spoken. You're the opposite of me. This is going to be an interesting experience for you. Thanks for coming on The U Project. Now, just in case anyone wants to know if Gemma is an expert, the answer is definitely not an expert, right? Not an expert. She knows a lot, but not an expert.
No one's an expert, hey?
Yeah, I'm with you. Like I said, what I'm talking about, folks, is before we went live, I said, do I call you this, that shit? Don't call me an expert. No one's an expert. And I kind of went, I like that because I say the same thing. I say, run from the person who calls him or herself an expert or a guru, run the other way. Run the other way, I say. So where do we find you today? I know where you are, but tell our listeners where you're based.
I'm based in the lovely Perth, Western Australia. I've been here about 3 years now. And before that, I was in regional Australia, country Australia, teaching in beautiful primary schools.
Wowza. And you have had an interesting journey, to say the least. So you clearly didn't start in Australia. Where did you start?
I grew up mostly in the sort of northwest area of Greater London in the UK.
And what did you now, obviously, which people will know because they will have read the intro or they will have read the copy or the synopsis of the show, that you work in the autism space advocating and helping and teaching and working with people in that area. But when you were growing up, what did you think you might do when you were big, in inverted commas?
I knew I wanted to be a teacher from an early age, actually. I think the only other thing I dabbled in was possibly acting or possibly some writing work. And teaching's, in my opinion, a beautiful service industry, and you get to be creative and you get to learn a lot and you get to be around amazing people and you get to do all of those things. So teaching has been a dream career for me.
I think teaching and nursing are vocations. I feel like that's not just a thing you do because you go, oh, that'd be a pretty good job. I feel like you need to almost have a calling on your life to go, because it's not the easiest job, but it can be the most rewarding job if that's what you're built for and you're passionate.
I agree. I think there's a number of careers like that. And if you've got the heart for it and it floats your boat and it makes you feel like you and it's a part of your identity, then you're one of the lucky few who get to do what they love.
And how long did you teach for? I know you still teach in a capacity at Edith Cowan University. You're an adjunct lecturer. We'll come to that in a minute. But how long did you teach for in the kind of school system?
Oh, so I taught for a few years in the UK before I emigrated, and then let me think. It would have been about 15 years in early childhood and primary school settings.
And how does it differ? How does it differ from the UK to here? Not necessarily what's better or worse, but just what's different.
Well, that's a huge question, and one I wasn't expecting.
Well, thanks, I'm Craig. Sorry, Melissa. Did you not send through the question? It doesn't have to be any wide, broad expose, but just, you know, it's like I'm sure that culturally and sociologically and you know, I'm sure there are some differences and academically, and the system would vary and the government kind of regs would vary. So as a teacher who's worked in both systems in on opposite sides of the world, how was it different for you?
When I first came, there was quite a significant contrast. And for me, I preferred the Australian system. I found there to be more of a focus on holistic well-being, things like daily fitness and things like that, which are very, very common, you know, in schools here. That was a new concept for me.
What did you say? What kind of fitness?
Daily fitness, you know, where you take the kids out for some form of exercise
Every day. Yep.
So that was different and a real positive. And I found that I had quite a lot of autonomy with how I delivered curriculum when I came to Australia. And I enjoyed that flexibility and the chance to individualize programs to my students with greater freedom than perhaps in the UK, where, in my view, the curriculum was very overcrowded and had become more target orientated than Australia. But I can't comment on the UK system now. It's been a long time since I taught there.
Mm. And now you work with big kids.
Now
you teach big kids at grown-up school.
I do, and I'm very lucky to have my students. It's a fantastic thing to come across passionate people at the, you know, beginning stage of their career. And I agree with you. I think, you know, the people who go into teaching by and large are those people who want to make a difference and be that teacher that's memorable, you know, that is creates learning environments and one-off lifelong memories that people remember for the rest of their life. It's, you know, what a privilege that is.
100%. So you're teaching primary teachers, or who are you working with?
I teach at the university. I teach early childhood and primary, and currently teaching into how to include students with disability into a mainstream setting, which is something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, of course. We'll come to that in a minute. I was just wondering, are we seeing more, let me ask a better question. Is there still a disproportionate number of women versus men primary teachers?
Oh, I don't have the stats for you there, but anecdotally, I would say that there's more women than men in primary schools, but you'd have to ask an expert, Craig.
I would, but you told me not to trust experts and they don't exist. So now I'm confused. Tell us about your kids. You've got a couple of kids. Tell us about them.
Well, I do have two beautiful children. They attend their local mainstream school and are beautifully supported. And I suppose the reason that you're talking to me and asking me about my children as opposed to pulling a random parent off the street is that my children have a number of diagnoses, and one of them is autism spectrum disorder, or ASD.
And how did you, when how old were the kids when you found that out?
That's a great question. So my son was typically developing until around 13 and a half months of age, and then experienced a regression in a number of areas of development, and his skills and his behaviors changed very dramatically. And that and it was very obvious to me that it was autism spectrum disorder. He requires very significant support. So in Australia, when a child meets criteria for ASD, the clinicians diagnosing that individual need to determine what level of supports they require, and their report will disclose whether they require level one, level two, level three supports. Level three supports means that the individual requires very significant supports so that they can reach their potential. and my son met that criteria. And then it was a very, very rapid induction into the world of what autism was, how it's perceived, how people judge it to be, the misconceptions, the stereotypes. For my beautiful daughter, autism is a largely heritable condition, largely. It's mostly genetic in cause, and there's a big disclaimer on that, and there's a lot that isn't known. So as many of your listeners might relate to, I suppose, is that once you've had a child with autism, you are made aware that your chances of having another child who meets the diagnostic criteria is increased. So some parents become quite hypervigilant and are looking for those early signs. So I certainly was with my daughter. And so I knew from a very young age, you know, but before she was one, that in my view, she was autistic. And she received her diagnosis around 16, 17 months. So that my daughter has language skills. And she is able to notice at the moment more more social information and process it. In comparison to my son. And they both have a number of strengths. It's incredible. I've learned so much from them and the entire autistic community, really, about how to support individuals on the spectrum with a strength-based approach. And I think that's a really important skill and attitude to acquire. It's not an easy one because it takes a lot of people out of their comfort zone.
What does that mean? What does that mean, a strength-based approach?
Well, by definition, autism is a disability, but in some ways it can be more of a difference. And regardless of your presentation, there's no one feature that defines someone's autism. Everyone is completely unique, just as the neurotypical general population community is completely unique. So I think a strength-based approach from an educator's point of view is looking at what an individual enjoys, what tops up their tank, what floats their boat, removing your judgment about what should float their boat and working with what does, as long as it, you know, is not unsafe, etc. And working out support strategies and functional goals that can support that individual to experience more joy in their life. So, for example, it's very helpful, as it is for many kids, autistic or not, to be able to have, you know, visual supports, let's say in the home or the classroom or a community. And there's a, you know, there's a number of reasons for that, right? You know, words are very transient, they come and go. So if a child who wasn't autistic but had working memory issues or language processing issues or had English as an additional language, visual supports are incredibly helpful to build independence. They can reduce anxiety with helping children understand when something will finish or what will happen next if they perhaps haven't yet developed the skills to anticipate change in their environment. That's really important. There's really a number of ways from language processing to helping make the invisible visible. That social narrative comes naturally to a lot of people, but it's sometimes harder for children on the spectrum.
The awareness around, and I know we still have a long way to go, but the awareness and the understanding and I guess the compassion seems to be evolving at a nice rate. Like I know, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even in Australia, I don't think autism was really understood. It's still not understood as well as it could be. I know that, but it was not spoken of very much. But there's a lot more awareness. There's a lot more, I guess, resources, still work to do. But do you think it's in a do you think where all the, you know, the community is and the facilities and resources available, we're heading in the right direction?
Yeah, of course, I think we're heading in the right direction in Australia. We have the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which whilst has does cause stress and has had, you know, a lot of teething problems and things like that, but by and large, this is a wonderful thing and to support people with disability. In the context of autism, it is such a unique neurodevelopmental condition that more awareness and more acceptance, that's going to be, I think, an endless to do this for us all.
Yeah.
There's a man named Dr. Bob Jackson, and I watched one of his lectures in the last couple of years, and he campaigned for true inclusion.
Mm.
And social inclusion is a big part of that, not just inclusion by proximity, you know, well, the kids are in the same class, so they're included. It's about inclusion on all levels. And I have his permission to share this quote that he uses because I think it's so, so powerful. So he shows, you know, a dead psychologist, you know, from the 19th century. And there's a quote that says, a desire to give them the same education, and consequence to propose the same goals for them is a dangerous chimera or fantasy. And
wow,
what Dr. Jackson points out is that this quote isn't about people with disability, it's about women.
Wow.
So
wow.
I think that's quite, yeah.
That's
so
amazing.
The change in attitude, the change in expectation, the change in understanding of neurodivergent culture, this is going to be ever changing and ever shifting. And once we get our heads around that, then to embrace it and be prepared to go outside our comfort zone can only accelerate that positive change, in my view.
Mm. You spoke before about, like, when you first learned about your son, how you, like, the door was flung open and it was a steep learning curve for you to understand, you know, everything that was wrapped around that. And one of those things that you mentioned was the misconceptions. What are some of the misconceptions that people might have around autism?
Thanks for asking such an important question. Maybe I'll fling it back to you. Have you got any misconceptions or things about autism that you wonder whether are true or not? Maybe I can dispel some myths for you.
Okay. Are they all awesome at maths?
Yeah, but myth.
All right.
Myth.
Is every second person with autism a musical prodigy? No.
Myth.
Not really. I think I still can certainly learn a lot. I'll just say that. But I maybe know a little bit more than the average person, but barely by the skin of my teeth. So, yeah. It's literally a spectrum. It's a scale. It's not like this is autism. It's like, you know, these things, you know, there's so much variation, isn't there?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And thanks for putting yourself out there without any choice at all about labeling some misconceptions.
Thanks for throwing me under the podcast bus. We'll bloody edit that.
So you're right. So with certain skills, there's a higher prevalence in the autistic population. So Savant syndrome is one of them. It's still just very, very, very tiny. Like having perfect pitch is more prevalent in autistic brains than it is in non-autistic brains. But it's still very, very rare. We have a large number of the autistic population who receive a diagnosis of intellectual disability. So we need to make sure that we advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves. I think that's a really important point, but also not to reduce our expectations, not to lower the bar and to find innovative new interventions that, you know, transcend curriculum and transcend sort of prior conceptions of what is possible or what should be possible. And create a holistic approach, a really team-based approach to figuring out how children can reach their potential, right?
100%. And the thing is, like, you know, whatever group we're working with, you know, be that people who are on the spectrum or people with another kind of disability or what we might call neurotypical people or whoever, or athletes or farmers or, you know, nurses, or, you know, the thing is that there is no single best approach for every individual. And so me coming from an exercise physiology background, you know, when people present, they go, this is where I am, this is where I want to be. So the process is similar in that, you know, this is my current level of whatever function, fitness, balance, capability in with these skills or these tasks or these requirements to get this thing done. And then so I would do an assessment on them, and then based on what they want to do, be create change based on their current level of performance and physiology and fitness in inverted commas, then you would take all of that on board. Then you would kind of create a plan with them, right? And but it's very, very unique to that individual, because I might get 20 ladies who come and see me this week, and they're all 40 years old and they're all kind of about the same height and weight or whatever, but none of them are actually in the same body. None of them have identical goals or backgrounds or medical issues or genetics or beliefs or values or expectations. Like, it's, I think whatever population we're working with, that's, we need to make sure that our thinking and our beliefs, our self-limiting beliefs, and even sometimes our naivety or lack of understanding doesn't get in the way of someone's potential.
I think that's a fantastic way to put it. I totally agree with everything you just said. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I just think that, you know, sometimes we, like, we look at somebody who might have a disability and we, I'm generalizing because I've probably done it, but we assume or judge, and we're not trying to be bad people, but part of the human experience is we automatically judge and evaluate people. Doesn't mean you're a bad human, just means you're a human. But sometimes, you know, like, I'm judging something or someone that I really don't understand. And that's going to, especially if I'm working with that person. Like, over the years, when, as an exercise scientist, I've worked with people who perhaps have had some kind of major accident or a medical issue, like a stroke or something like that, where the thing is that even if we get five guys who have had a stroke on the same day, their issues are all going to be different. There'll be some overlap, but that none of them will be identical to each other, and their rate of recovery and their what's required for their rehab and their program, and not only just physiologically, but emotionally and psychologically, what will work not just with each body, but with each human. And I guess mm-hmm. this is the same in terms of dealing with individuals in this space to be able to best meet their needs. There's no generic program.
Yes, you're entirely right. And I think that's true, as you say, for all humans. This is, you know, what you're describing is respectful and ethical and engineered to support your clients on an individual basis. So that's quite common sense, isn't it? In the world of children with autism, what can often be misconceived is their behavior, the purpose of their behavior, the function, the intention. So let me give you an example. Okay, so recently I was in a education setting where a young girl on the spectrum was, and I'm going to use language that I'm then going to contextualize and correct, but the student was engaging in problem behavior, and it was behavior that wasn't being managed effectively in the eyes of the educators. And that behavior was screaming and flopping to the floor, and, you know, very, very disruptive behavior. And it certainly was really distracting. And and certainly was a massive barrier for learning for not only her, but for all of her peers. So this is a genuine problem after what we would call a functional behavior analysis. To cut a long story short, this was an issue of not understanding how she was perceiving other people's behavior. So this beautiful student who had full verbal capacity, no intellectual disability, actually slightly above average academically, was getting very, very, very upset because she couldn't bear the thought of all these children around her hitting each other. And that's what she was seeing, because it's important to remember that autism is a condition that, you know, it affects how people interact with others and experience their environment and how a person thinks. And we need to check our privilege around that. It's a social and communication disability by definition. And this young girl was getting incredibly upset. She's a really caring, beautiful person, because she didn't understand that her peers were high-fiving.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So it had to be explained to her. And you'll see a lot of self-advocates who have autism themselves, who Aspie Kids is a great line of books for people listening who are interested. And there's a nice phrase that I've stolen, that sometimes for some individuals, social skills and social understanding can be quite a cognitive achievement. So it's also quite common for students like this beautiful young girl I met, you know, who's academically able, who's compliant and angelic in terms of her compliance and respectful behavior towards her teachers. But when she's at home, her functional ability crashes. She's absolutely exhausted from trying to process not only what she's being taught in the curriculum academically, but also trying to figure out, what are they hitting? I've been told it's wrong to hit, so they're breaking the rules. Why aren't they getting into trouble? If I hit someone, I get into trouble.
Yeah.
So making the invisible visible, right? Making that social narrative. Often when I'm working with allied health professionals or educators to bring this point home, I'll show a photo of kids playing hide and seek, you know, a kid sort of hiding behind a tree or something like that, and another person with their hands over their eyes. And I point to the child who's hiding and I'll say, what are they doing? Tell me one word. And they'll say, hiding. Okay, and they've got that from a 2D image. But that may, and lots of autistic people would also answer like that too, but some wouldn't. Some would say crouching or kneeling or sitting or whatever they were doing, because sometimes they struggle to interpret the social narrative or the social intent or the purpose of what's going on in their environment. It's not uncommon for individuals on the spectrum to be quite literal in their thinking and quite focused on the language component. Yeah. Of interactions, because language is just a code, right? So I would say, you know, I would really encourage therapists or teachers working with children on the spectrum to remember that language and communication are distinct things, as is speech, really. It's a bit of a triangle. And for communication, typically developing brains kind of learn themselves that for communication there has to be a sender, there has to be a receiver, there has to be some sort of exchange of message that carries meaning. Now that's five components of something that we take for granted. So we need to check our privilege with our social and communication development, and that will help us understand and unpack what support some children may need. Is that I'm not sure if that's a good unpacking or not.
No, that makes perfect sense. And In a more broad sense, I talk to people all the time, you know, in my work about, you know, awareness and self-awareness. My PhD is in self-awareness, and I talk about understanding someone else's reality, you know, and one of the questions I ask rooms full of people when I'm doing a presentation, often I ask the question, put up your hand if you think you're open-minded and objective, and every hand goes up, and then I go, none of you are. And they go, what do you mean? And I go, well, we can be open-minded a bit, but for, you know, when you think that all of us have pre-existing thoughts and ideas and biases and, you know, beliefs and values, and that's the window through which we analyze and view the world. And I think whenever we look at somebody else's behavior, or we hear someone else's words, or we look at an interaction, we also have to be aware that we're processing that through our own filter. And to us, we might see somebody doing something which for them is completely normal, but for us it's inappropriate, or it's them acting out, mm-hmm. or to us it makes no sense. But to the person doing the thing, it makes all the sense in the world. I guess my long-winded roundabout question is, and this is just way too broad, but maybe you can do something with it. But so for people who, you know, don't really understand, have a good understanding of autism, or dealing with people with, you know, who are on the spectrum, when they meet someone, do you have any advice? Like, how can we create connection? How can we do that first encounter well, or as well as we can?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's really important, just like it is for anyone with a difference or a disability, if you were trying to engage with someone, for example, who was in a wheelchair, what a lot of people tend to do is feel a little bit uncomfortable with not knowing what to do. So they look at the person pushing the wheelchair.
Oh, wow.
So I think it's important, just like someone with a, you know, a mobility disability would say, hey, talk to me, address me, I'm a real person too. I think that's to consider also. And I guess try to banish the should. That person may not respond to you in a conventional way, and it might make you feel uncomfortable. Some individuals on the spectrum, you know, really flap their hands when they're happy, and that's their expression of joy. And you might not be comfortable with that because you prefer to, you know, grin or, you know, punch the air. It's different. Mm. So, you know, the issue you raise is, you know, it's political in terms of, well, to what level of behavior is ethical to intervene with. But also it's a question about ourselves. I come across this with teachers a lot. It's the notion that we're not really sure how we can perform at our best. We're not really sure how we can cater for someone's needs. So perhaps someone over there is better off at doing that. We've heard some great things, you know,
yeah.
They've got better resources, or and so we, without meaning to, we disengage with a concept that in theory we'd agree to, which is that of inclusion and implementing the Disability and Education Act, for example, from 2005. To go back to your question, I'm sorry, I'm answering it badly. So engage with the person and try not to be judgmental in their response. Asking them what suits them, not being offended if they don't make eye contact. For some autistic individuals with language, they say that eye contact's painful for them. For some, it's not painful, but it's as intimate as kissing, you know, and they can't look someone in the eye until they're, you know, comfortable with their company. Also using language that doesn't relate to too many invisible things. So what I mean by that is to use specific language, try to avoid metaphor if you can help it. Many people listening may have come across individuals on the spectrum, particularly in childhood, who find pronouns difficult or they misuse pronouns until quite a late age, he, she, I, you. And that's very, very common, because if you think about how you learn what those words mean, those words mean something different every time. Okay. If I said, what's this, what's this, what's this, what's this, your brain has to interpret other information. It's a nonverbal communication of a point. You couldn't answer that question if your eyes were closed, right?
Yes.
So that links back to what I was saying about, you know, a tendency to rely on language, because that's a specific code that is more consistent. Nonverbal communication is really nuanced, really difficult. And again, we need to check our privilege and understand that what comes naturally and easy to some people is a real cognitive achievement for people to understand those social etiquettes and conventions so that they're not perceived as rude or obnoxious or arrogant or lazy or stupid or naughty. And for those children requiring more significant supports, without a village around them with a lot of skills and understanding and abilities to teach well with intensive supports, those children who may not get the opportunity to develop language skills, how can they possibly be supported to reach their potential without being taught how to communicate and those components? Okay, if you went to another country and you didn't speak the language, that triangle, you would have language and speech removed. You wouldn't be able to use those resources, but you'd find a way to communicate with them. And that's the right of everyone, disability or not. So we have to support functional communication as a top priority.
I love it. So note to self, Harps, no inferring, no metaphors, and no sarcasm. Off the table.
Well, I know many autistic individuals who love a bit of sarcasm. So it comes back to what you said about absolutely everyone being completely different. But yeah, if they're capable of answering a question about what works for them, then of course, just like, you know, we had a conversation the other day about what would work for us, you know, in terms of organizing this telephone conversation. So treat people as you want to be treated. It's the universal design, right?
Hey, so something that's been sitting on my cerebral shelf for 20 minutes since you said it was, so you were saying that, and I may stuff a bit of this up, so correct me if you need to, but that your son was kind of developmentally normal till he was about 13 and a half months, and then there was a regression. Do we know why that happens?
Good question. The short answer for regressional onset is no, not really. Autism is diagnosed, you know, mostly through observation. So in terms of when he met diagnostic criteria with the current, you know, diagnostic and statistical manual, it was at that point. There were very early red flags earlier on that just weren't enough to meet criteria. And also what is true for some people with autism is not true for all. So, for example, we know, you know, some autistic individuals in the first 12 months of life have, you know, quite a big head due to increased brain surface area. My son was like that, you know, he had a massive head, but that's not enough to be diagnosed autistic. There's plenty of non-autistic individuals who happen to be blessed with bowling ball heads, you know. So there are certainly early markers, and there's eye tracking research going on. There's a fascinating research all over the world. So, you know, for example, what I noticed with my daughter around the age of sort of 4 to 6 months was that if she was struggling or she was distressed, you know, let's say she was hungry or something like that, that her eyes, instead of scanning for sort of a social being, you know, a person or an animal, her eyes would drift towards something that was prevalent in multiple environments. So we, you know, she was seeking sameness. So she had a tendency to look at the blinds over windows, for example, because, you know, at that point, the house she was living in, you know, most windows had a lot of blinds, and she found those patterns of light quite comforting. So from a neurotransmitter point of view, that was topping up her tank. That was making her feel better. As an autistic young woman, she might also use that strategy to self-regulate because she finds it calming. But what wouldn't reduce any sort of disabling features of her autism and allow me to support her beautifully to become the person with, you know, pursuing the hobbies and pastimes to what she wants, as if I wasn't able to intervene in some way to help her brain understand that good things happen around people. And that's one of the most positive and rewarding things you can do with those babies at risk, is to pair yourself with things that top up their tank, so that the likelihood of social anxiety maybe slightly reduced, so that certainly when you're looking at behavior of those really young ones, that they might initiate the behavior of attending to a person or approaching a person or even approaching a peer. And if those behaviors aren't demonstrated, just like they would be for any child, you know, autistic or not, their opportunities to engage in incidental learning experiences is massively jeopardized.
Mm.
So, you know, as you would know, I'm sure in your field, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together.
Mm.
And we have to help these kids maximize, give them, help them develop a skill set that maximizes function and maximizes joy, because you don't learn unless you're happy. So I'll give you another story.
Yeah, please.
And this, you know, this covers a lot of issues, really. I mean, when we talk about goals and intervention, of course, we have making sure people are safe. And then for kids, we have the big three, the sleeping, the eating, and the toileting, you know. And then after that, different professionals go in different ways. So I'm going to just give you my take on it, I suppose, as a parent professional. And it comes back to experiencing joy. But I was working with a young man who had an amazing team, you know, therapy team working collaboratively with the school, collaboratively with the parents. It was a really beautiful setup, and there'd been a lot of progress. And they've been working on social inclusion. So this young man being around peers and being able to communicate requests as a nonverbal individual. So communicate requests with picture exchange so that he could invite his friends to play.
Wow. How old, can I ask?
Upper primary.
Yep.
So then one day out of nowhere, he refused to go to the playgrounds. Now, this is after 2 years of work of getting this kid who had a coordination disorder as well, a physical disability. So, you know, we were kicking a lot of goals here. You know, the physio was on board, the core strength had improved, the motor planning had improved, the social inclusion, the peers were, you know, celebrating, you know, his achievements with him. It was, you know, absolutely warm fuzzies all around. And then one day he just stopped, and he had receptive language, so he could, you know, he was a beautiful kid, perfectly, you know, engaged and compliant if he understood what was being asked of him. But if someone tried to say, hey, let's go over here, he would get very, very, very upset. And again, that problem behavior started to occur. And what's important in these situations is that the team surrounding the child can not work just to modify that behavior and think, well, he's screaming and crying or hitting and self-harming, let's just, you know, let's just reward him when he's not doing that, and hopefully those rates of problem behavior will reduce. What's ethical, you know, what everyone deserves is why, you know, what's the problem here, what's he thinking, what's he feeling? Mm. But for a kid without a lot of expressive language, without the ability to use the code of language describe individual things, to describe abstract ideas or concepts, this is where it gets really tricky with supporting kids who require significant supports. So that's why you have to be able to have functional communication and target them. So it took about a year working on functional communication goals. We worked on nouns so that he could label the different equipment in the playground. This is all with nonverbal communication supports. And to cut a very long story short, this young man was refusing to go back to any playground because he'd got some, what I assume were quite painful static shocks from playground equipment.
Wow.
Right? He didn't have the communication skills to go, what was that? That really hurt. He wasn't, hadn't noticed his peers getting static shocks or how they reacted to it, or he didn't understand what strategies he could deploy to reduce the chances of him getting static shocks. For him, it just came out of nowhere. You know, imagine how stressful you would be if suddenly now you've got an electric shock. You know, you would not want to go back to that chair you were sitting in, or that microphone, or that desk, or, you know, your lovely producer, you know, perhaps it was her.
She is shocking. So that's
there you go.
Yep. Boom. Da-da-da, boom. I'm here every Sunday. Thanks, everyone. Mm-mm.
So, you know, who'd have thought it? But, you know, we had to go into quite a sort of a goal setting procedure of teaching this kid about, you know, static energy and how to discharge and how to ensure that he could enjoy playgrounds again.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit, when your lovely friend Jolene Laverick sent me the big sales pitch on you, which I know you would never do on yourself, but she did, and said, you've got to have my friend Gemma on because she's all kinds of awesome. Had a little bit of a read of you. And one of the things I read was that as a mum of two working full time, you did a full time PhD with full time work while looking after your gorgeous children. Did I get that right? Is that what happened?
That's true.
And I also heard that you did your PhD, a little bit jealous, in 3 years. Is that true?
Probably nearing 3.5, but ballpark.
What did you do your PhD in?
It was a PhD in education, looking at what mainstream educators need to know about autism spectrum disorder.
And what was your thesis? What was your kind of, or what was your main focus? And what did you come up with? and no pressure, and 2 minutes. Ready, set, and all we want is 3.5 years of work and research and toil and pain in 2 minutes.
Oh my goodness. Well, the answer is everything, isn't it? You know, what the teachers need to know, everything, what the parents need to know, everything. It's really tricky. My PhD was practice-based research, so it allowed me to reports on significant data from 4 fields that I sort of have my finger in the pie for, I suppose. So that's the academic field, the research field, the education, the teaching field, and the parent family carer field, and the therapist field. When my son was diagnosed, he wasn't able to attend his daycare anymore, and so I took unpaid leave from my teaching job and retrained and learned everything I could know about progressive behavior analysis and what had gone wrong in the past, what the misconceptions were, what positive changes could occur, what a holistic approach actually meant, what a strength-based program meant, what expectations could I have, what, you know, how could I, the crystal ball for every parent listening can be quite terrifying. And I think it's important that the pressure from both within and outside the autism community is skewed towards support and not division. So for some parents, this is a really, really tough gig. We're talking about extreme levels of sleep deprivation, self-injurious behavior, property damage, social isolation, co-occurring medical diagnoses. For some individuals on the spectrum, it's a case of understanding that, and celebrating neurodiversity, and really campaigning for increased awareness and acceptance. But I guess the takeaway message for me is that there's a lot of literature already out there about intervention and support for kids on the spectrum. I think what worries me most at the moment is that there's a sort of fallacy of mutual exclusion. And there was a blog on this recently on the National Council for Severe Autism. And they talked about that. Well, my take on it, I suppose, was that we can respect and love and advocate and care for people with disabilities while working to reduce the disabling features of their condition where possible. And there shouldn't be any shame attached to wanting your child to be able to tell you that they're crying because they've got a toothache. At the same time, it's important to fight discrimination without removing the value from, you know, evidence-based interventions and therapies. And And that what that means in modern day society is that we're not trying to make our children less or autistic or remove that component of their identity. It's part of who they are. It's that social model of disability. But by definition, autism is a disability, and some kids are clearly, you know, experience really difficult challenges, which impacts quality of life for them and their family and their carers and their siblings and their community. And I don't want to lift my foot off the gas. I can't for my own children. And I think professionals working in this really privileged space have a responsibility to prioritize social and communication goals, prioritize how a child experiences joy, help them know that good things do happen around people, and you're not going to carry on putting demands and demands and demands on them. And that a quality of life has to be achieved through an individualized approach, just like you have your clients achieve and thrive and develop a quality of life so they can meet their potential. It looks different for kids on the spectrum because we have to check our privilege, and we have to not make assumptions that they're doing things because that's the reason we would do things.
Yeah, that's so true. It's so true. Because if some kids, neurotypical kids or whatever, whatever we might want to say, you know, did something like that, we would say they're just acting out, behaving badly, seeking attention. But when kids on the spectrum do that, it's a completely different thing.
It may well be. But every child, regardless of their, you know, behavior, deserves support and access to education. And, you know, Australia have protected that in law. And we have incredible programs and incredible professionals. I'd love to give a shout out to Yellow Ladybugs, who we haven't touched on females on the spectrum today, but that's an incredible resource for girls who are massively underdiagnosed all over the world because they're able to mask and imitate socially conventional behaviors more effectively sometimes than their male peers. And there's often you find females are diagnosed with mental health conditions in adolescence. Eating disorders is a really common one. And it turns out that, you know, actually they're on the spectrum and need support from someone who understands autism and autistic identity. To counteract that, I also think it's important that for those who are not autistic and are working to serve the autism community, that what their views and opinions and suggestions and service and, you know, practices are not excluded from consideration or are not undervalued because they're not autistic. It's really important to listen to autistic voices, and it's also really important to do what works for the individual and tailor make build the village that supports them. I don't think you know, one person can't speak for another. There's a great resource called the Autism Cafe run by an autistic lady named Eileen Lamb, and she writes on this issue really eloquently about self-advocacy and so on. So that's another really interesting resource. And I'd also like to recommend two resources if listeners are going to go away and look up a couple of things, that if they look, Google image autism the positives, which is a post that's come out of the University of Leeds in the UK, I think. It's a fantastic resource to keep in mind when trying to tailor make learning experiences for kids on the spectrum. And I mean, there's dozens and dozens of incredible resources. The Autism CRC, the Cooperative Research Council in Australia, has resources for teachers, for therapists, for schools, for parents. There's so many fantastic supports available in Australia. So if people are listening and they want to know how they can access support or reach out and find their tribe, then they can get in touch with me at actforautism.com.au, or they can hopefully, if they're an NDIS participant, speak to their partner who's helping them navigate that system. But you don't have to do it alone, I think, is a really important message for individuals and their carers.
Wow. you're great.
I didn't answer your question about my PhD at all. That's
nah,
it's a good
all right.
deflection.
Don't worry. I love how you deflected there. Well, you're awesome. Have you heard the word since you moved over here? Have you heard the word grouse?
No, I haven't. I mean, I know fair dinkum. Can I have that one?
Yeah, fair dinkum's okay, but it's not fair dinkum.
What's grouse? Or is it grouse? Is it like a drop bear? Is this a massive humiliation?
No. Grouse means ace. It's like,
that's it?
Fucking, yeah, like two thumbs up. Awesome. Grouse.
Do I need to Google this to see if you're pranking me?
Yeah, go on. Google it right now. Google grouse, Australian slang.
It is legit. I promise you.
Let her do it. It's not super common.
Let's see.
grouse. This is live on the U Project. This is Dr. Gemma Foxall. Bloody just seeing if I'm full of shit. Well, I'm full of shit.
No, you're grouse, Craig. It's very good.
Thank you. Did you find it?
Yeah, I found it. It says it's from like a sort of surfy type context, but I'll take it. Grouse.
Means good. Grouse means you're great.
It means very good. I'm going to use that every day this week.
Grouse. Now, do you... Grouse, mate. You just did a little bit of sharing of resources and places to go. Is there anything else that you want to plug? Is there a book? Is there another resource? Is there, like, if people want to support in any way, is there anything else you want to share before we say goodbye?
Oh, that's really kind of you. I'd like to say a special thanks to Associate Professor Lorraine Hammond and to an incredible autism advocate, Liz Martin. I'd like to say thanks to Dr. Christina Gray, to Clara Harris, and to Erin Leaf and Professor Tony Atwood, who are Tony, I believe, has volunteered kindly to write the foreword to my book. So next stop a publisher, if anyone's listening.
Perfect. We need a publisher. Actually, you and I might have a talk about self-publishing, because you might make lots more money. I know it's not about the money, but you can still do good things and still educate the world and inspire the masses and make a few dollars. So we might have a talk about that.
Thank you, Craig. It's been a real pleasure, genuinely. And thank you very much for having me, even though we didn't do a virtual cheers. It's been a real pleasure. And thanks for letting me represent as best as I can and support the autism community and talk about their topics of interest a little bit. Thank you.
Well, you can come back anytime you want, because you're terrific. Stay there.
Grouse.
You're grouse, bro. stay there. We're going to say goodbye. Melissa, do I need to... Oh, you know what we need? Oh, we'll get Gemma to do that off air, won't we?
Sounds good.
We're doing a new little thing, folks. You'll hear about it very soon. All right, everybody. Love you guts. See you next time.